Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. When the Scottish poet Robert Burns wrote, "Man's inhumanity to man makes countless thousands mourn," he obviously wasn't talking about the tragedy of modern mass migration, but he could have been. Today, thousands, indeed millions of people are being driven from their homes by war, natural disasters, climate change, pestilence, poverty, or sometimes just a search for better opportunities, as was the case when my grandparents left Poland for the United States 100 years ago. Unfortunately, today there aren't enough welcoming destinations for all the people on the move. In light of the politics around migration in Europe, as well as in the United States, but also in important destination countries in the global South, there is little reason to believe that situation will do anything but worsen in the coming years. The results are tragic, although they're becoming so commonplace that they seem to go mostly unnoticed. Mostly is the key word. There are, thank God, legions of people who not only notice, but try to do something about this modern version of man's inhumanity to man. My guest is someone who lives on the front lines of that inhumanity. Sasa Chanoff is founder of Refuge Point, an organization dedicated to creating solutions for refugees in extreme danger. Welcome, Sasha, to New Thinking for a New World.
It's such a pleasure to be here, Alan. Thanks so much. My great-grandparents also came to the U.S. from Poland 100 years ago.
Well, that's why I invited you.
Good.
To go to the point, am I exaggerating the dimensions and the urgency of the global refugee issue?
No, you're certainly not. I mean, we've entered a new age. I think of it as the age of forced migration. To put some numbers onto that, by the end of 2024, there will be over 120 million people who fled their home because of violence, persecution, climate change, and other reasons. And that number is anticipated to go up pretty dramatically. So we have certainly entered an age that I think you could term the age of forced migration. Man's inhumanity to man is certainly a powerful way to frame things. I think there are a lot of incredibly positive things and opportunities that are available in this new age of forced migration as well. And I'm excited to dive into those.
When it comes to people fleeing what they're fleeing, we're dealing, it seems, with the classic irresistible force meeting the immovable object, mass migration on the one hand, growing resistance to migrants on the other hand. I deliberately chose the Burns framing because it really does seem there's almost no limit to the potential for cold-heartedness when it comes to dealing with migration. Why?
Well, you certainly do see that. And to put a little more context to what you've said, you see that that Europe is funding Libya to try to keep people there. You see Australia, which has externalized migration, as you and I talked a little about before this, by putting people on the islands of Nauru and Manus. You see in many different places where countries that are receiving people or where people want to get to because they think that they can build new and stable lives are not letting them in. That's certainly one dimension of it. On the other hand, you also see a lot of people in many of these same countries who are stepping up to support people. And there are many examples of that too in Canada, in the US, around private sponsorship for refugees. New pathways and avenues are opening up. So I would say in this age of forced migration, you have both man's inhumanity to man. That is, you have politicians' xenophobic rhetoric that look to keep people out and look to capitalize on the fear that some people have and create power around that. On the other hand, you have many people like myself millions across the US and Canada and European countries who feel strongly that there are incredible opportunities when you welcome people, that the people who are fleeing home are not necessarily victims, but are people with incredible ingenuity and skills and experience they can bring to bear to help their communities thrive when they're welcomed. And there are incredible opportunities around that too. So I think you're seeing these cross currents. One is more countries trying to keep people away, but the other is the fact that countries need people. There are a number of programs that are being built today around family reunion, labor mobility, private sponsorship of refugees that are creating opportunities for tens of thousands and soon hundreds of thousands, and I think in the future, millions. And that's actually needed because so many countries are actually diminishing in terms of their population, in terms of workforce.
I'd like to come back to that in a bit because, and I don't know if we have time to talk about technology, but we've seen just since the pandemic, a push on the technology side to solve the labor problem with technology rather than with people. So I want to reserve a caveat here that I'm not sure that's not a transitional issue that doesn't over time disappear. But I want to go back though and maybe start with Europe. It wasn't that long ago when we had Angela Merkel stand up and say, we can do this, as you had the massive push during the early Syrian war days into Europe. And we've gone from we can do this to, oh my God, send them to Rwanda or Tunisia or Albania or Mexico or anywhere but here. So there's been a shift and it's reflected in the polls. You're certainly right. There are many people, just not enough, that want to welcome migrants, refugees, asylum seekers, whatever is the right term of art. But on balance, it doesn't seem to be the case. It seems to be shifting towards the strengthening of borders, the building of walls, not just Donald Trump's walls, but lots of people's walls. Am I being too pessimistic? I see the good, but I see bad sort of larger than the good.
Alan, I've spent many, many decades of my life dedicated to creating legal migration pathways for refugees through refugee resettlement, which is a legal process to identify people in countries to which they fled, but where they can't stay safely, and help them get to countries like the US, Canada, EU countries, and other places where they can build lives safely. Labor mobility for refugees, which is a new sphere, and there are ongoing needs and will be more and more, even though we'll also have technology opportunities. Family reunion efforts. So yes, you do see on the one hand countries that are closing their borders. On the other hand, you also see many countries creating more legal migration pathways for people. Let's take the US just for example. This current administration right now has opened up pathways through refugee resettlement to bring people in. It has also reached deep into the American population to say, you people living in America can raise your hand and sponsor a refugee or someone forced from home to come to America. And in the past couple of years, over 750,000 people have arrived because Americans have come together in groups and said, I want to sponsor someone, meaning I will provide housing, I'll provide financial support, and the opportunity for them to integrate, taking on that responsibility. At the same time, there are other opportunities for people to move safely from one place to another. So while we are seeing this externalization, which is so dangerous, we are seeing borders close up more and more. We're also seeing more legal migration pathways in some cases open up to Europe too. And so there are these counter trends, but I firmly believe that if we can reframe the narrative a little, away from the xenophobic rhetoric, away from the idea that people are victims, and toward the idea that people have incredible ingenuity and ability and can and do contribute to their communities, you can start to build, I think, more people who are interested in supporting legal pathways and people fleeing their homes.
Well, that's indeed one of the directions I wanted to go in. How do you shift popular opinion? How do you shift elite opinion, particularly in Europe and the United States, which are obviously the engines of the two of the major engines of the global economy and two of the most attractive places for people to try to get to.
Yeah. Well, let's look at a few examples. One of the things that the organization I lead, Refuge Point, is involved with, along with a number of governments and other organizations, is something called labor mobility for refugees. Canada is the first country that piloted this. Essentially, what happened was that the Canadian government looked at its workforce and some of the companies working there in the healthcare industry initially and said, we don't have enough people to work for an aging population that needs healthcare. Canada turned to Refuge Point and another organization called Talent Beyond Boundaries and the UN Refugee Agency and said, would you help us build a program to identify refugees with healthcare skills that match our employer needs for employers who can't find people in Canada? We did that. It's happening now from Kenya to Canada, from Jordan to Canada. And we found all these people who have been refugees in Kenya for decades, have healthcare skills, are nurses, and yet weren't legally allowed to work in Kenya or really build their lives there safely or adequately. We connected them with employers in Canada. They have gone to Nova Scotia as kind of the first pilot place for this program and have integrated there, got jobs, even bought houses, have become citizens, and the community there needs them. I was working with the Minister of Immigration of Canada when we were starting this program, and he said, we need this program not only to support refugees, which is important for Canada, but primarily to support rural communities in my area. He was from Nova Scotia himself, because otherwise schools will close, healthcare facilities will close. This is incredibly important for Canada. And now we're seeing that many European countries are taking this on, as well as the US, to build labor mobility opportunities. This is just one dimension of where I see forced migration going and the opportunities that are available in it. But if you think about the job needs across the US and Europe right now, I think there's like 9 million jobs available in the US. The workforce in Europe, just to keep it intact, between now and 2050, we are going to need 60 million people, I believe. And that's not going to come from a dwindling European population. That's going to come from external, from people coming in from elsewhere.
That's a different conversation to have, but every numerator needs a denominator. And it is quite clear, your point's well taken, there are many successful programs to try to move talented, skilled labor into markets that need that talented, skilled labor. But as you yourself said at the top of the conversation, the number of people being forced to move is many, many multiples of that numerator. So it's not that there's no programs, but it is the case even in Canada. The recent polling I've seen now says that a majority of Canadians think there are too many migrants in their country. I think you are certainly right that if it can be reframed, but the reframing doesn't seem to be working. I see it in everything I see in European politics, Germany, France, Italy, Spain, the UK, everything I see in American politics, the same thing. And it's not just the crazy right. It's majorities in country after country. So we need a reframing, I guess, is my point. It may well be the reframing is around needed skilled labor. It may well be the reframing is around morality. We need more discussions of morality and humanity than we have, but I'm not sure how to get there.
Yeah. You know, Alan, there's some very real challenges that the increasing number of people who are fleeing home and seeking asylum in other countries present. Housing is a huge issue, but also in the US, I just wrote an op-ed about this. The fact that so many people have arrived through the southern border to seek asylum and have arrived in cities like New York and Chicago and other places have led to homeless shelters, which are full, to emergency rooms, which are full. And so what do you do about that? One of the things that I think you can do about that is to create the more legal migration pathways, because these are planned processes where you anticipate and know who is arriving. And once you have that, and you have communities that are ready to welcome and able to welcome, and once you have groups who are sponsoring refugees, who've said, I'll pay for the housing, I'll take care of this financially, initially for people when they arrive, then it's more of a planned process. So I think if we can increase these legal migration pathways, and that's one of the dimensions that I think can start to change attitudes. At the same time, there's a whole piece of this around trying to support people in the countries to which they've fled so they don't feel the need to risk their lives in the arms of traffickers in dangerous onward journeys to get to another country. Now, legal migration pathways are useful, but as you said, that's not a panacea in any way. I think what is just as important, perhaps the most important thing we can do, is look at the countries that are hosting people. That is, look at Jordan that's hosting Syrians, look at Kenya that's hosting Somalis and South Sudanese and Congolese and others, look at Colombia hosting Venezuelans, look at those countries and say, how can we support those countries so that they can make the lives of people fleeing there sustainable and normal? And there's a whole...
Let me interrupt just to say who's...
Yeah, go ahead.
You got to define we. One of the words that I least like in language is we, because there's a tendency to talk about we at a humane, at a global level, when we at a global level doesn't really exist in many ways. When you say we have to find ways to support, I don't disagree with you, but who do you mean by we? Because you've got the reality of Zaatari in Jordan, Kakuma in Kenya, and Cox Bazar in Bangladesh, which are horrible places. They're dumping grounds for humanity. They're huge. I can't imagine spending a day, never mind a lifetime, in these places. We should be ashamed, but we don't do shame very well anymore.
Yeah. I want to answer that we, but just before we started this call, I got a very emotional and powerful message from a man who has lived in Kakuma camp his entire life as a refugee.
Give our audience some context on Kakuma.
Okay. So Kakuma camp in Kenya was started in 1990, 1991. It's been there for over 30 years now. There is over 100,000 refugees from Somalia, Sudan, Congo, and other countries that have fled to Kenya and go to Kakuma camp. As you said, it's not a place where you want to spend a day, let alone a year or a lifetime. It's a rough place. I've spent a lot of time there over the years. It's arid. People are trying to eke out an existence when there's not enough food, there's not enough support, and it's kind of brutal in many ways. And yet people have managed to survive and some even thrive there. But many people are looking for a way out, especially when they're in danger. So this young man, his mom carried him from Somalia to Kakuma, and her fervent wish was to get out of there, but she died 27 years later in Kakuma. He had married and had three children in Kakuma. The thing he wants to do more than anything is get out of Kakuma and not have to raise his three daughters in Kakuma. I was part of a group in the U.S. that sponsored him, and he just sent me a message right before you and I got on a call saying that he may have his first interview soon. So if Trump wins the U.S. election, that program may disappear or be dramatically reduced, and he won't have a chance. However, if Trump does not win, Kamala Harris wins, we will continue with a resettlement program, and he may have an opportunity to come to the U.S. I share this because across the U.S. now, there are about 2 million people who've raised their hands and said, I want to sponsor someone to come here. Across 50 states, 12,000 zip codes, it's like this underground movement that people don't know about because the top line is what we hear from the politicians, the xenophobic rhetoric and keep people out. But underneath that, you're seeing people, Republicans and Democrats alike, who are actually sponsoring refugees to come here. So there is hope and there is optimism here. And for me personally, when I saw that email, I got that email, I felt really emotional about it because when I met this guy, I thought, God damn the world for putting people in places where they have to spend an entire lifetime and have their children born there. We need a new way to approach things. People, there should be some cutoff. My goodness, if you have spent a lifetime in a refugee camp, you have to have the right to get out and build your life somewhere else. So I'm hopeful that there are more opportunities to do that. I do want to go back and define the we that you just talked about. Shall I jump into that? Well, when I said the we about supporting people who fled to countries that are hosting them, like Somalis to Kenya or Syrians to Jordan, for example, I was thinking actually specifically about a new movement that is built thanks to Refuge Point, the Women's Refugee Commission, the UN Refugee Agency, and many governments and others, called the Refugee Self-Reliance Initiative, which is aimed at reframing humanitarian response away from emergency tents, food, and aid year after year, which are necessary at the outset of a crisis when people initially flee and need to stay alive, but don't make sense if you've been a refugee for 1 or 5 or 10 or even 20 years. Reframing it toward supporting people to support themselves so they can build normal lives, contribute to their communities, and essentially have a safe roof over their heads and food on the table and get their kids into school and aspire to the things that you and I aspire to too for ourselves and our families. This movement has now hundreds of partners and many governments who are also committed to advancing self-reliance opportunities for refugees stuck in host countries interminably. And last year at something called the Global Refugee Forum, which was a convening of governments and world leaders who came together, there was pledges made to advance self-reliance in this initiative, the Self-Reliance Initiative, along with the U.S. government and the U.N. and others, collectively got 260 or so governments and organizations and foundations to pledge to advance these opportunities for refugees. So when I say we, I'm talking about the concerned global community that wants to take action to do something about this.
What do war lessons from Gaza, rethinking education, peace in Ukraine, and visionary leadership have in common? They are all themes from recent episodes of this podcast. Check out more episodes on talbergfoundation.org or on a platform of your choice.
I am going to push back because many of the countries that signed because it's a classic example of greenwashing, because they actually behave differently in fact. You have a country like Sweden, which wanted to make self-reliance and integration work and for decades worked hard at it, and would now tell you that they're failing, that they've given up. Now, that's not to push on the Swedes. It's to say that I have my own view of these global summits where everybody from the big banks to the big oil companies to the big whatever sign documents and then go on and on. But that's not the point. The point is that we need practical solutions as well as to shift the mindset. And Refuge Point and you in particular have worked, and you have that Kenya example, which is an absolutely wonderful example. So maybe we should describe what you're actually doing in Kenya that is potentially can be replicated. And indeed, people may well be interested in replicating it. So how do you go into Kakuma or somewhere else and build something, even if it's a tiny compared to the size of the problem?
Yeah.
What have you done?
Well, first, just to go to your example of Sweden, when I'm talking about self-reliance for people, I'm actually referring to the countries that are hosting the vast majority of refugees in the world: Turkey, Jordan, Uganda, Ethiopia. I'm not talking about countries that a lot of people are trying to get to, like Sweden, or perceive that they could build a better life if they got there. I'm talking about all those countries that are hosting the vast majority of refugees. So what does self-reliance look like, and what does that mean? Essentially, it means, as I said, the ability of someone to support him or herself and her family, have a roof over their heads, food on the table, kids in school. In Kenya, and maybe I'll go into this specific example, the organization that I founded, Refuge Point, we found that there were many refugees who had fled from the refugee camps in Kenya, Kakuma and the other camp called Dadaab, and ended up in Nairobi, a city. And they really didn't have much support there. And so we started supporting them there. But then we created, in collaboration with refugees themselves, and thanks to private funding, which enabled us to be nimble and responsive and change quickly, a program that provided interventions that laddered up to the idea of self-reliance. So people need some emergency food. If you had arrived there, Alan, let's just take you as an example. You'll arrive and we would meet with you and say, Alan, we see that you're sick. You might be injured with a gunshot, even from fleeing violence. You have your kids here. They're not doing well. You don't know where to sleep tonight. You don't know where you're going to eat. You're in a really bad situation. We're going to give you some food. We're going to give you shelter. But while you don't have to think about this right now, we want to start working toward you supporting yourself. So what did you do before? And you might say, well, I was the chairman of the Talberg Foundation and I led this really cool thing.
Which makes me definitely unemployable.
We need
a better example, I'm afraid.
You did something else too that maybe you could earn an income doing. Let's say you were a plumber and you're a handyman and you have skills and you can build things. So we'd say, Alan, we want to work with you. We're going to assign a case manager to work with you to make out a plan for you around how you can get on your own two feet. And we're going to take care of these other things for you, some food, some shelter. Also, since you seem a little traumatized, we have opportunities for counseling because we've seen that mental health and the ability to earn an income really go hand in hand in many ways when you can address mental health issues. So we created this holistic program with a lot of different kinds of time-limited interventions and found over time, as we started to analyze our impact, that people were actually going from a place of real desperation and vulnerability to about a year to 2 years later, a place where they were actually supporting themselves. And Alan, it was so cool to see this because I was meeting with many people that we were supporting. And by the way, our work in Kenya is led by Kenyans and refugees themselves supporting other refugees in collaboration with them. What was amazing is that, you know, people like physically carry the burden of refugee life in their shoulders and in how they stand and in how they look often. And then you see a year or two later that they're doing better. I remember walking into the home of a Congolese woman who was a widow with three kids. And when we first met her, she was in a really rough situation. When I came into her home 2 years later, she had two cell phones going. She was dressed beautifully. She's like, excuse me, I have two businesses I'm running, because she was a businesswoman in Congo. And we helped her build a new business after we took care of some of those basic needs. And she wasn't earning an income. And when I asked what the biggest challenges she had in her life were, she said, well, I got to figure out how to pay for my kids' secondary school. And I thought, if that's the biggest challenge right now, when we met you, you were worried about surviving day to day. That's a good thing. You've come a long way. So we found that we were able to support people, and now it's been thousands of people. We created a way to measure the impact around this to get to a point where they're supporting themselves. They have some optimism for the future and feel like they have somewhat of a normal life. And then we translated those lessons into a global initiative called the Refugee Self-Reliance Initiative, which we co-created with an organization called the Women's Refugee Commission, which was in some ways doing similar work to ours, and said, let's try to spread these ideas and this orientation around the world. And today we have about 60 partners in 30 countries who are using a measurement tool that was co-created to measure the impact of programming that leads to self-reliance. We have advocacy around governments making better policy decisions that enable self-reliance. And there's a lot actually happening in this space. We're starting to even see funding go toward this as well. So there is some hope. And I think this is a new trajectory for humanitarian response, since we're seeing that money for food and basic assistance is dwindling. And yet, if you can spend a couple of years supporting someone to support themselves, then they don't need as much assistance.
What would it take to scale this big enough to move the needle on the overall problem?
Yeah, it's a good question. Our initial goal, when I say our, this is a collective we, the organizations that came together to co-create the Refugee Self-Reliance Initiative. We thought if we can reach 5 million people in 5 years and show the results of self-reliance programming, we can start to change humanitarian action. Today, we've reached over 2 million people through partnerships in many different countries. putting people on a path to self-reliance, creating an evidence base of what works, using that evidence base to inform advocacy and make better programming decisions with organizations that are getting funding. What would it take? It would take more funding from governments, from the UN Refugee Agency to orient around this. And we're seeing that too. With the pledges that I mentioned earlier, there was about $1 billion that a number of governments said, we want to pledge this to go in one form or another towards self-reliance opportunities. So we're starting to see a bit of a sea change and a lot of opportunity around that. Even the Sustainable Development Goals now include refugees, where the Millennium Development Goals did not. But now there's a recognition that when people have fled to a neighboring country, they're kind of stuck there forever. Now, I mentioned the Somali guy that's been in Kakuma for almost 30 years, and that's not uncommon. And so if people are stuck for generations, they should actually be included in development agendas too. So we're seeing some kind of, there's always been rhetoric around how do the humanitarian and development agendas come together, but I'm actually seeing some of that start to take shape.
One of the issues in this space is the legal framework, which is to say the 1951 Refugee Convention was built for a different world. Its 1967 protocol update was built for a different world, different set of problems, different scale of problems. I guess it's two sides of the same coin. On the one hand, do you see any realistic chance to reimagine the legal framework globally? And if so, what would it take in the world we live in, where Europe is what Europe is, United States is what United States is, Chinese are more or less absent from much of this. So the global powers aren't pushing hard for a new legal framework.
Yeah.
Do we need one?
Well, we certainly are seeing some evidence of new legal frameworks. There's a specific definition for refugees, right? People who fled their home because of persecution and violence and are afraid for a variety of reasons to return home. But now we're seeing more and more people who are displaced because of climate change and other reasons. So the migration that we're seeing today is coming from kind of many different sources, right? War in Sudan, war in Ukraine, war in Gaza, war in other places that is displacing people and putting them at great risk. But at the same time, we're seeing that people are fleeing because of climate too. So there's actually some efforts in the US right now to include a quota of people who would come here because of climate, and they would have the same access to the resources that the refugee resettlement program, that the people who come through that program have. That is, when they arrive in the US, they have a legal pathway to citizenship. They can apply for citizenship for 5 years and they get the support. Just like other people get support in the US, they access the benefits that are available in each state. So there's a bill right now to think about how to take a quota of people and allow them to come to the US through because they have fled climate challenges. I think we're going to see more and more of that. I do think that one of the keys to the future of humanitarian response is building more legal pathways. So there is a known way that people can move from one place to another so that it reduces the opportunism and horror that traffickers take on and inflict on people. And so we can create more stability in the world. I think another key to humanitarianism and addressing global problems is the idea of self-reliance in the countries to which people are fled and often where they're stuck.
But specifically in terms of the global framework, you, by the way you answered the question, don't see much opportunity, don't see much effort to create a new global legal framework.
You know, I think that because of the
I'm not arguing there'd be.
I get your point. I think because of the xenophobia, I think there's been a bit of a reluctance to try to get governments to come together and create new and better frameworks, because it's almost like we're clawing to keep what we have, like with the UN Refugee Convention. However, I also think that there are opportunities to create more pathways, more more ways to address climate displacement as well as displacement because of war that might not necessarily amount to a new global framework at the start. But it's like when you see something that works and you build on that, that can actually lead in the future to new global frameworks. With the self-reliance stuff that we've done, it's like this little program relative to the numbers of people forcibly displaced that we created in Nairobi, which was one of the catalysts for this self-reliance movement that is really taking shape globally now. So I think that those kinds of things can lead to new kind of frameworks. I mean, even with like the Global Compact for Refugees is a new global framework, a roadmap that the world created, that the UN Refugee Agency led along with governments to say, this is what we have to do for refugees. And a lot of the things in that were similar to the 1951 Refugee Convention. Help people go home, help them integrate in the countries to which they fled, and create resettlement opportunities also for them. But a new dimension, a new pillar of the Global Compact on Refugees was self-reliance. That is supporting people in the countries to which they fled to build normal lives, and at the same time supporting host communities so that those host communities don't see refugees benefiting more than they benefit. And I think that's a key too, is like figuring out how to support those host communities along with refugees.
I know this is a very cynical way to end an absolutely wonderful conversation, but I have to confess, I have much more both hope and optimism about the kinds of work that an organization like Refugee Point are doing on the ground with real people and changing their lives than I do with the diplomats and yet another global compact. So perhaps end there. Thank God you're doing what you're doing. We need more people doing what you're doing. I really don't expect the diplomats to be part of the solution, but maybe they will be.
In response to yours about thank God for the people out there doing what they're doing and let's not leave it to the politicians, there is something else that's happening in the world, which is a democratization, as I see it, of humanitarian response. That is, more and more people are coming into contact with refugees and people fleeing home from the US to Greece to many other countries. And when people do come face to face with others, it changes them. It actually makes them more empathetic and understanding. And when more and more people have those kinds of opportunities, I think they see that the people who are fleeing home, that the other is not really the other, but there's so much that we have in common together. And there's almost like a sense of moral obligation to do something about it. And when more and more people have those kinds of opportunities, hopefully that can be a swell of grassroots interest in changing how politicians and how the world is behaving right now. I hear your cynicism, and I'm going to bring just a measure of optimism that we can change things and do better for the people who are fleeing home. And not only can we do that, we must do that, because war and conflict are some of the scourges of the earth that have been there forever. And if we can stand up and prevent those, or at least protect people fleeing from them and enable them to build new lives, it supports them, it supports communities, and it creates a better world. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you, Sasha Chanoff, for this conversation and for the work that you do.
Thanks a lot, Alan.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.